all those who are online. Good afternoon to those who are here in person. To the person who I think is just walking in the door to the building, since you get this great view through the window there. We are in serious trouble in terms of finishing this story. But we're going to do the best we can with it. What I hope to do today is to wrap up chapter 9, as well as to see a significant chunk of chapter 10. And then we'll see where it goes from there. Welcome. So last time round, we began chapter 9 by recapping what we knew about Shlomo, about Solomon, the good, the bad, the ambiguous, what the good being his piety, his character, his wisdom, the concerns being the halakhic issues like marrying an Egyptian wife, some of the apparent self-aggrandizement that some of the commentators noted, his alliances with Tyre and with Egypt were a cause for concern. And then we began the chapter by seeing Solomon's conversation with Hashem, or really the message from Hashem. This was the third of his four messages from God, which on the one hand said, I'm going to accept what you asked for. You asked me to be with the with this house that you have built. I'm going to do that. It's very positive. On the other hand, as we noted, God is only willing to do that which Solomon asked, as opposed to the way that that it was in his first vision in chapter 3, where God said, I'll give you whatever you want, and he gave Solomon even more than Solomon asked for. Plus, this vision was heavy on the warning of what's going to happen if Solomon does not live up to God's expectations. Then we detoured to talk about the 20 unsatisfactory cities. Right, Solomon gave Hiram 20 cities. Hiram didn't like those cities. In Divrei Hayamim, we found out that Hiram gave Solomon 20 cities. What in the world is that about? So Radak said that it's a land swap, trading 20 for 20. However, Abarbanel did not like that explanation, and we noted various reasons not to like that explanation, especially the fact that you're now telling me there's a land swap, but 20 cities are mentioned in one book and 20 cities are mentioned in a different book. Very strange. Abarbanel said no. Solomon was supposed to pay Hiram an annual fee for the work that he had done on, you know, providing materials and so on for the Beis HaMikdash. He assigned cities that would be used to provide what he had promised to Hiram, what he had promised to Hiram. Hiram looks at the cities and says, these can't provide it. And he gives the cities back, meaning he says, we're not getting it from these cities. And then Solomon populates the cities with people who, sure enough, are able to provide what he has promised. And the whole point of the section seems to be a warning sign about, again, alliances that he's making with others, although you could also read it as a sign of Solomon's wisdom, which is how Abarbanel reads it. Abarbanel will find anything and everything positive to say about Solomon. He never wants anything negative to say. He's very dumb lakavskos, always. So what I want to do with the rest of chapter 9 is point out three and a half issues, but really primarily three. The first goes back to a question that that I know has been bothering some of us. I think Susan Pearl had actually asked about this a while ago. And that is, who paid for all this? Who paid for all of this construction that Solomon is doing? I mean, just the materials themselves. I understand that you're able to pay Hiram off of the produce from cities, but where are you getting all of this, especially when we noted that he didn't use the materials from David, right? David's materials get deposited in the treasury. So where did you get all the stuff that you amassed in order to build it? And you have all of these building projects. If you take a look at chapter 9, sentence 15, we get a nice list. He built the house of God. He built the Milo. We're going to talk about that. The wall of Jerusalem, Chatzor, Megiddo, Gezer, which we're going to have to talk about. There's an awful lot of building projects here. And so sentence 15 begins, Vized Divar Hamas. Divar, the word Davar can mean different things in different contexts. Here it seems to mean these were the cause for the Mas. What is the mas? What does mas normally mean to you? Taxes, which you pay with money, right? That's usually the way we, in our culture, in our society, think about mas. However, that's not the meaning of mas going back to biblical times. The meaning of mas in biblical times was very often labor. You conquered people, and then you used them for your building projects, and people had to do shifts on the building projects. So take a look, please, at chapter 9, sentence 20. I'm going to come back to the part in between 15 and 20 later, but take a look at sentence 20, please. We read this ages ago when we were talking about who built the Beis HaMikdash and which groups were drawn upon. So we quoted this then. We're told that the Canaanite tribes who remained in the land, Chiti, Prizi, etc., Asher lo mibnei Yisrael hema, they're not Jewish, b'neihem asher nosru achareihem ba'aretz, their descendants who remained in the land, asher lo yachlu b'nei Yisrael ha'achrimam, who the Jews were not able to eliminate for one reason or another, we don't say why. V'yaleim shlamo l'mas oved ad hayom hazeh. Remember, the Jews came into the land with a mission. God said, even if you, the Jewish people, were not entering the land, I would want to get rid of those who are currently there. They have built a corrupt, abusive, idolatrous society, and I have no interest in them being here anymore. Your job coming into the land is to get rid of that civilization. You can get them to follow the seven Noahide laws. That's wonderful. That's great. You can't? They can leave. They won't leave. Then there's going to be a war. That's what happened originally. That was the set of instructions the Jews had on approaching the land. So we're told here that nonetheless, Canaanites remain in the land. And these people, Vayalem Shlomo Lamas Oved Adayom Hazeh, so Shlomo created work gangs. He said, you are going to be responsible to work on this construction. Whereas the Jews, Pasuk Chav Beis, Umi B'nei Yisrael, as far as the Jews, Lanasan Shlomo Aved, he didn't make them work. Kihem Anshei HaMelchama, they fought the war. Da V'sara V'shalisha V'sara Rechbo V'farasha, they had lots to do, but they were not workers for the construction of the Beis HaMikdash. Now, the truth of the matter is that back in chapter 5, sentences 27 and 28, we did see laborers. If you go back to chapter 5, sentences 27 and 28, we were told, flipping back within my own book here. Yeah.
There were a lot of them.
So we don't get numbers here. There's actually a whole confusion. Sorry? Right, so there's a whole confusion about the numbers because there are contradictions between the numbers given in Malachim and the ones given in Divrei Hayamim. And all the commentators wrestle with it. But that's one of those things that ended up on the cutting room floor in my desire to hit the major points of the book. But yes, if you continue reading in chapter 9, you get a little bit in terms of the numbers. And also, if you go back to chapter 5, I think there were numbers there as well. But what I wanted to show you here in chapter 5, sentence 27, there you find out that there is a mas from all of the Jews, shloshim elef ish, there you have 30,000, and he sends them to Levanon. So here you do have Jews working, but the Malbim explains that those are just involved in getting the wood for the Beis HaMikdash. Those aren't the people who are doing the building.
But Jews did not build the Beis HaMikdash.
Correct. That is exactly correct. And in fact, if you were to look in Divrei Hayamim, and I gave you the references on your sheet in source number 1, but we're not going to go into it now. You can look up the sources when you have a chance. David gathered gerim, foreigners, to do the work for the Beis HaMikdash. Don't think when you hear the word ger, don't think convert. That's not what we mean. We mean foreigners to do the work for the Beis HaMikdash. So what you're seeing here is that you have work crews, you have materials, but where is the money come from? Where is the money coming from? How is he paying for it? So one possibility is that he taxed the Jews. It is a possibility. Rashi seems to think so. Because back in chapter 5, when we read that there was a mas on the Jews, and we said it was 30,000 men. If you take a look at source number 2 on your sheet, you see that Rashi says, "V'yamas olel le'sachar shel 30,000 ish." It wasn't that there were 30,000 Jews who became workers. It was that he got the Jews to pay the salary of 30,000 workers. That's the way that Rashi reads it. Radak really doesn't like it. It doesn't fit the language in the text very well. The text goes on there to describe shifts and how many per month and all of that. It doesn't sound like it's about paying people. It sounds like you're actually working. But if I don't take Rashi's view, if I don't take the view that what's going on is a collection of money from the Jews, how does Shlomo pay for all of it? So here you get Don Isaac Abarbanel. And Abarbanel is picking up on the text itself, and based on the conversation I had with Debbie while we were waiting for everybody before, I realized I should probably show you a pasuk first. Jump to chapter 9, sentence 26, please. This will describe Shlomo's fleet. Etzion Gaver was a port down south. So if you look at the description there in sentences 26, sentence 27, sentence 28, you find that Hiram of Tzor, who was, of course, seagoing, right? They were the major port in the region, teams up with Shlomo to send boats to a place called Ophir. And in Ophir, they get lots and lots of gold and bring it back to Shlomo. So Abarbanel says, that's where Shlomo gets his gold. It's this passage right here. Now take a look on your sheet, please, at source number 3 to see Abarbanel say it. V'achrei shezachar godel ha-hotza'ah asher asa Shlomo b'binyanim uvavodes beis hamikdash, after it mentioned the great expenditures that Shlomo had to make for the construction and the work, but at the same time it informed us that he didn't take any money from the Jews, and he didn't take any money from the foreigners either. All he did with the foreigners was that he had them do the work for the Beis HaMikdash, for the buildings. So then the question is, where did he get the gold? Right, we noted already, he didn't take what David left. That he put into the stores. Barbanel says the answer is, he got the gold elsewhere. He imported the gold. Now, that only is a partial answer to the question. Right? It's only a partial answer to the question. Because how did you get the gold in Ophir? What does that mean? You just sent boats and they loaded up the boats with gold and then you came home?
And who owns the Ophir? Yeah,
right. So Abarbanel writes elsewhere. I thought he actually had it in this one also. But it's not in the part that I excerpted. But Abarbanel expands and says that he sent goods. This was import-export. Shlomo is sending goods overseas and he's bringing back gold. But now I want you to think about this in terms of who Don Isaac Abarbanel was. When did he live?
15th century.
End of the 15th century, beginning of the 16th century.
The time of the Inquisition.
Yes, but not the Inquisition isn't what matters on this. Tell me something, what was his job?
He was Minister of Finance.
Minister of Finance to whom?
Isabella.
Sorry?
Queen Isabella.
To Ferdinand and Isabella in Spain, right? What was Spain doing? What was their main source of income at this point in time, the end of the 15th century?
Shipping.
Exploring, right? They sent out their boats, right? Seeking to trade, right? Everyone's looking for the Indies, right? Get the spices. That's what's going on. Abarbanel is reading the story here in light of his experience. How is it that we get our gold? We ship out goods. And we try to swear in order to get gold. So that's what he's seeing in the story here. I think it's crystal clear that that's his influence.
Export business, as one would say.
Yeah, that's exactly what he's doing. We've been in this business for a long time. So Abarbanel is adamant, though, that the Jews are not themselves involved in the process. Take a look at source number 4. Hisba'er shehaya kavana b'chol ha-sipur hazeh, she'asa Shlomo binyanim rabim gedolim va'atzumim. You get the message of this entire story that Shlomo made these great buildings. V'lo he'elamas mi-Yisrael, he did not make any collection or forced labor from Israel. V'lo asu nedava, they didn't donate either. V'lo truma, there was no donation me'atzmam, on their own. Kasher asu anshe ha-midbar l'maseh ha-mishkan, like in the midbar, like with the mishkan. All he had was the work of these other tribes. That's all that Shlomo is getting. Shlomo is doing this himself, which of course, and we've said this before, is a bad thing. Right? We don't want this to be a Shlomo project. We want this to be a national project. So we don't like that. And therefore, I see you, Moish, hang in there. The lack of a tax may be a bad thing, not a good thing. You know, people say, well, that's great, he's not taxing the people, maybe he should be taxing the people. If you take a look on your sheet, it's source number 5, we quoted this when we talked in back in chapter 5 about who was doing the work and who wasn't doing the work, so I'm just going to read out my English translation quickly from Rabbi Yitzchak Levi. He says, in the sanctuary, on the other hand, as opposed to the Mishkan, the royal and empiric aspect stands out. The nation of Israel is already established in its country. The monarchy is established. The construction of the sanctuary is performed as one of the royal mitzvot after establishing a king and destroying Amalek. The ties formed with neighboring nations for this purpose testify regarding the royal slash empire aspect of the building of the sanctuary. This is the king's building. The nation itself is not close to the matters of the sanctuary. In the time of Shiloh, there was idolatry in the land. Also, when there was a major altar in Nob and Givon, the ark was in Kiryat Yarim and Ir David, we don't find any special interest of the nation in these places. The king was the planner, organizer, executor of the building of the sanctuary, and the nation's role was primarily in the tax, whatever that was, he's following Rashi, that he collected from them. And also in the future, he says, I have news for you. The Mashiach, according to the Rambam and Hilchos Malachim, Mashiach is charged with building the Beis HaMikdash. It's not necessarily a national project. So, yeah.
This is intentional.
It seems to be intentional, yes.
They weren't involved in the building. They weren't involved in the project.
Yeah.
They weren't involved at all.
Yep, he's making it a royal project.
It's a bit.
It's not what I would have expected. We value so much when we learn Chumash Shmos, right? And it says not only they volunteered, but all those, Kol Nediv Lev, and the men, and the women, and we say that in the end, Vehoser, they actually had extra, they had more than they needed, and Moshe had to say, stop bringing. That is an ideal. This doesn't seem like a good thing to me. Rabbi Yitzchak Levi seems to be okay with it by the fact that he says, yeah, the Beis HaMikdash is going to be that way also. But this is something I'm uncomfortable with. I think that we're supposed to be. So Moshe has had his hand up for a while, so I'll take Moshe first. Go ahead, Moshe.
I just want to raise an issue that really has to do with Avraham Avinu far more than Shlomo HaMelech. That is that what Avraham Avinu is disclosing is a totally colonialist narrative. They're not doing anything other than you expand your empire, you get all these other goods back. There wasn't any trade as such. They were just bringing stuff home for their own trade. It was just a totally...
So I think, Moish, I think that it's important to distinguish between trade and colonialism. And I realize that in the era of the explorers, they went hand in hand, but it doesn't have to be so. In other words, he's not describing them taking over land in Ophir. He's not describing the establishment of a Jewish colony in Ophir. All he's describing is trade, and he writes about that explicitly. So I wouldn't want to go too far with that.
I'm not talking about his Jewish connection. I'm simply talking about the Ferdinand and Isabella.
Uh-huh.
They were totally colonialist. This is a classic colonialist. You'll never see anything more than that.
Okay, I hear you. Others online, before I go to those in the room. Nope, okay, Devi.
Just a small point. I use the JPS translation. We talk about laborers and workers. The word they use all the time is slaves and slavery.
Interesting.
Any of the passages.
The problem that we have.
Different.
Right. So Debbie points out that the JPS translation translates the word Eved as slave, not as worker, not as servant. The problem fundamentally is that we have a clumsy word, meaning the word in Hebrew, eved, is legitimately used for both. And I make fun of translations for exactly what you just pointed out when the translation changes it based on what's more appealing. So in certain cases, they'll say, we were avadim in Egypt, we were slaves.
Yeah, right.
You know, the concept of an eved to a Jew, then it's a servant, suddenly. At the same time, I have nothing to indicate slavery here, except that the hallmark of slavery in Tanakh is you don't have the freedom to leave. That's what makes somebody a slave. It's not abuse. It's not torture. Those things are generally speaking, foreign to the prescription, you know, for the Eved in the Torah. However, they don't have the freedom to leave. And if the king says to you, you're going to provide 10,000 workers this month, then those 10,000 workers don't have the option of walking off the job. And in that case, yes, I think slave is an accurate translation. The problem also is the connotations that automatically arise with the word. We assume being whipped, abused, you know, brought in from Africa, and so on. Yeah, it really does. I agree with that. Okay, so this is being paid for by the gold Shlomo brings from Ophir, which he has acquired in trade. That brings us to two problems with the daughter of the Pharaoh. Right? We introduced her back in chapter 3. We talked then about the inappropriateness of marrying her. You ain't seen nothing yet. Take a look, please, at sentence 16 in chapter 9. One of the building projects that we mentioned here. Actually, no. Well, it is. One of the projects we mentioned is a city called Gezer. Okay? Don't think carrot. Although, maybe it had the shape. I don't know. Paro Melech Mitzrayim Allah Vayokodes Gezer Vayisrefa Bo Eish. Paro, king of Egypt, ascended, came up from Egypt, conquered Gezer, burned it. Vesaknania Yoshev Vayir Harag. He executed the residents, the Kananim. Vayitnashi Luchim Levito Eish at Shlomo. And he gave it as a dowry from her side for the for his daughter. We have a long history in Tanakh with Gezer, and it's not a successful history. I gave you references on your sheet in source number 6, but we're not going to look them up right now. You can if you want to. But in Yoshua chapter 10, sentence 33, we find, remember that the Jews fought a war to defend the Canaanim and Gibeon, right? The Canaanim and Gibeon had tricked the Jews into a treaty. The Jews chose to honor the treaty anyway, even though they were tricked. Then the rest of the Canaanim are very angry. How could you make a treaty with the Jews? The result of that is that they go to war against Gibeon and the Jews defend them. After that war, and that war is famous for the stopping of the sun and the moon, right, in Gibeon. After that war, Gezer joins forces with Lachish to battle Yehoshua. Gezer joins forces with Lachish to battle Yoshua. Then, in Yoshua chapter 16, also recorded in Shoftim chapter 1, we learn that Gezer is in the portion of Ephraim, and Ephraim fails to conquer Gezer, and instead they live at peace with them. Fast forward to the time of King David, as described in Divrei Hayamim, I gave you the reference on the sheet in source number 6, we get the wars of David's day, and at that point, the Plishtim, the Philistines, are actually in control of Gezer. But now it's Canaanite. And Egypt conquers Gezer and says, Shlomo, Pharaoh, here is a present for you. Ricky, I see your hand, but I want you to hear the whole thing, and then I'll take comments and questions. So Egypt is taking care of it. For those who are into archaeology, I gave you a reference in source number 7, an article by Dr. Sam Wolf, titled A Sleeping Giant Awakens: The New Excavations of King Solomon's City of Gezer. There's a lot that's been done on it, and go ahead and read it. But what I wanted to highlight, and the reason why I'm talking about this, is it gives us two negatives, right? Number one, Egypt is doing our job of conquering the land. Right? I mean, we were supposed to do it, and Egypt has to come up north in order to take care of it. That's number one. Number two, it further builds the Egypt-Israel alliance, or really, reliance. right, which we already noted back in chapter 3 is problematic, and it's only going to get worse. So this gift marks a problem on multiple fronts. Questions from those in the room? Okay, Ricky, yes.
I'm on mute, I'm okay?
You're fine.
Gezer is very central. It wasn't far from the kibbutz where I grew up. How did Egypt get to Gezer? Wasn't it like it was the middle of Israel?
Yes, and Egypt, as the major military force in the region, had no problem, apparently.
So it went by...
It went through the land. They went right through the land. They went right through. They destroyed it and handed it over.
How can it do that?
What do you mean? Who was going to stop them?
Shlomo.
No, they're doing this for Shlomo.
I don't understand.
Did you wait? Hang on, Ricky.
You can go through Canada.
Ricky.
And go to
hang on. It was this was a dowry. This was a present.
I know, but this. In the middle of Israel, he would have had to march past.
Yes. He sends a message to Shlomo. He says, I am bringing in my troops. We're going to conquer the city of Gezer. I'm giving it to my daughter as a present. Shlomo says, okay. Because Shlomo knows that for centuries, the Jews have not been able to do it. That's exactly what we've been saying.
But that's not okay.
Why not?
Because he's giving away.
No, it's to us.
Who did
Gezer
belong to?
Okay. Gezer, again, I'm going to go back to what we had said before. Gezer was a Canaanite city. The Jews were supposed to take it. The Jews were supposed to take it. It was supposed to go to the tribe of Ephraim. We tracked how in Yehoshua, in Shoftim, in Divrei Hayamim, down through the ages, the Jews did not take over Gezer. Now Egypt is coming through and taking it on their behalf. That's the idea. That's what's going on. And Shlomo says, thank you very much. Rose. Rose, you're muted.
Is Gezer Ramada?
No.
Oh, no. Where is Gezer now?
So it is, as Ricky said, it's pretty central within the country. It is north of Yerushalayim. I'm looking at the Dot Mikra to see if he actually has a map. I've looked it up on maps on other occasions, but I don't see a map here for it. But it's north of Yerushalayim. It's a pretty pretty central site. Yes. Okay, Janine. No, only as an archaeological dig. Yes, Janine.
I'm trying to figure out the chronology of Tesbab and Tesayim. It looks like Shlomo had already subdued Gezer because he was getting a must from them.
Right, so it's not. The way to read it, to read those sentences is that Tesvav, sentence 15, there's a map in the Stone Tanakh, for those who have that in the back. So can you describe Gezer at all? Alina has the map in the back of the... Oh, wait a minute, I have one.
Right on the border, on the western border of Ephraim and Dan, actually.
Ah, okay. The western border of Ephraim and Dan. Oh, there, I see it. Yes. Yeah, no, it's pretty central. It's, as we said, it's above, it's going to be... north of Yerushalayim and to the west as you get towards the Mediterranean coast. According to the map of the Art Scroll, page 2048. Thank you very much. Yeah, it's listed there because it's one of the cities that the Levium have. But going back to the question that Jean just asked, the way to read it is that sentence 15 is describing the building projects for which Shlomo took the mas, and it mentions Gezer, and therefore it sees fit to explain... this is how we got Gezer, which Shlomo built up. We got Gezer because Paro conquered it on our behalf and gave it to his daughter. And now, Shlomo has to build it because you get a present from your father-in-law. Like, what are you going to do? You can't just like leave it somewhere. He has to build it up now. So,
but how did he get anything if Paro burned it and destroyed it?
That's exactly the point. Paro burns it and destroys it, and now Shlomo has to build it up again. That's exactly the point. Paro leveled the city, handed it over, said, look, I've gotten rid of your Canaanite problem, and now Shlomo, has to make it pretty. This is what happens when you get presents that you don't like. That's the way it works. Okay. Are we now clear about Gezer? Okay. So that brings us to the second problem with the daughter of Paro. And here we have something that really... I should have left for chapter 11, but I chose not to because we have enough to see in chapter 11. So we're going to see it. We're going to see it now. It's a critical part of Shlomo's ultimate downfall. So take a look at chapter 9, sentence 24, please. We already said, when we listed Shlomo's building projects, we mentioned a place called the Milo in sentence 15 that Shlomo built up, right? His house and the Milo. But we didn't say what a Milo is. Clearly, it's connected to the word male, full, but what does that mean? Well, take a look at sentence 24. Ach bas paro alsa meir David el beisa asher banala. Only, or but, the daughter of the Pharaoh ascended from Ir David to the palace that Shlomo built for her. Az bana es hamilo. That's when Shlomo built up the Milo, which we saw above. So we want to know when Shlomo built up the Milo. It was when he made the palace on behalf of the daughter of Paro. Now, there's a lot to talk about here. I'm going to do the best I can with this, but I want people to please hold questions and comments until you've heard the whole thing so that we understand what we're talking about. I'll pause and ask for questions when I'm ready for it. So the first thing is you need to take a look at Divrei Hayamim Bet, Divrei Hayamim 2, Chapter 8, sentence 11. It's on your sheet in source number 8. You see the reference. This is a critical sentence. Although it's just going to leave us more confused than we were before. So, Divrei Hayamim Bet, chapter 8, it's page 1957 if you're using the Stone Tanakh, is describing to us all of Shlomo's construction as well as the tax and the workers and all of that. And then it says, the daughter of the Pharaoh, Hela Shlomo, Meir David, Shlomo brought her up from the city of David, Labayis Asher Banalav, to the house that he built for her, Ki Amar, because he said, Lo Se Shev Isha Li Beveis David Melech Yisrael, no woman should dwell in the house of David, king of Israel, Ki Kodesh Hema Asher Ba'a El Alehem Aron Hashem. It is sacred because the Ark of God has arrived there. What in the world does this mean? A woman shouldn't be in the house of David? What are you talking about? This is very hard to understand. So Radak writes, what I brought for you in source number 9. Radak says, Va'af al pi shalo haya ha'aron ki'im ba'achad me'habatim ha'mekudash lo. Even though the Aron was not actually in all of these houses in the complex, right? Ir David is a big place. There are a lot of different buildings in it. It's not like the Aron is in all of the buildings. She could have been in one building and the Aron is in the Beis HaMikdash. Ava pichein chashav kol habatim ha-mekudashim kevan shenichnas sham ha-aron. Nonetheless, he considers all of these to be consecrated because the Aron is in the complex. That is already good enough. The Aron is in the complex. Therefore, she shouldn't be in any of the buildings. But still, why? What's your issue? So Abarbanel says in source number 10, Pen yomru sha'isa bas paro b'makom ha'aron asher amad sham. Lest people say that Pharaoh's daughter was in the place where the Aron stood. I'm not entirely clear on what that exactly means. The best that I can come up with is to associate this with an unsavory phenomenon that existed in the idolatries of Canaan. There was a practice that there were women who were dedicated for a particular purpose in their temples. We have a term in Hebrew, kidesha, that some claim is connected to that, that the Torah is trying to ban that practice. But the practice existed in Canaanite cultures. And I wonder if that isn't what we are referring to here, the fear that people will say that's what the daughter of the Pharaoh is doing here in the palace complex, and therefore he's moving her out. Interestingly, Malbim makes a very interesting point. Debbie, this goes back to what we were talking about in terms of how you figure things out from the text. This is a quirk that Malbim picks up on. It takes a Malbim eye. Go back for a second back into Malachim, chapter 9, sentence 24. Did you notice the description of how the daughter of the Pharaoh went? Alta. Now look at the sentence in Divrei Hayamim. How did she go? He'ela. What's the difference? They're both going up. In Malachim, it says that she went on her own. Divrei Hayamim says Shlomo brought her up. So Malvim says he told her, this is going to be a much better place to live. You're going to really have your own palace. It'll be great. And therefore, she went on her own. That's where Malvim reads it. He's deducing it based on the fact that in one place it says she went up, and in one place it says he brought her up. I have loads of problems understanding what we're talking about here. First of all, I would have assumed that the reason why he's concerned about her being there is not because she's female, but because she is the daughter of the Pharaoh. And you know that's a problem. He wasn't supposed to marry the daughter of the Pharaoh. I would have thought that. But the text in Divrei Hayamim, which brings in an explanation that we didn't see in Malachim, that line about it's not appropriate for a woman to be there wasn't even in Malachim. The Divrei Hayamim version makes it about any woman, which I find very interesting, that Malachim doesn't do that at all. I would, from the Malachim version, I would have just said it's just about her being the daughter of the Pharaoh. And then third, Shlomo already has another wife. Right? Shlomo is married to Naama. Right? Long ago when we did chapter 3, someone emailed me to point out, because I hadn't realized it, Naama is already his wife before he becomes king. Because he's king for 40 years, and after him is Rechavam, who's 41 years old when he takes the throne. So he already has a wife, Naama. No one mentioned anything about Naama and where she's living. I don't know if that's because Bat Paro gets the headlines, or, again, the Malachim version of it is it's not about being a woman. It's about being daughter of the Pharaoh, perhaps. Unclear, very unclear. I have so many questions about that segment that I can't answer. But it's just a very interesting segment in its own right. Now, we still have to see the construction of the Milo. But I'm going to pause here for questions and comments about about Pharaoh's daughter moving out of where she's been into a palace of her own. First, those in the room, questions and comments about that? Okay, those online. Yes, Ricky.
Could it also be that with her living so close, Pharaoh would have literally a foothold in the holy city?
It's an interesting idea. I mean, certainly against the Divrei Hayamim version of it, but it would fit with Malachim's omission of that point. I hear you. I hear the possibility. Dalia and then Moish. So for that, I'm going to send you to the recordings from chapter 3. We spent an entire hour on her.
Okay,
no problem. Okay, Maish.
I'd like to suggest the Masada answer. Masada was actually, the summer holiday castle of King Herod. And why wouldn't it be the same sort of thing for Shlomo to have what we call now a cottage?
Right, so Moish suggests that maybe this was Shlomo's summer cottage. The problem is we already saw his summer cottage, right? Back in chapter 5, when we described his buildings, we talked about the Mekerah, the cooling area that had a lot of open windows and all of that. It was a different space, Beit Yair Levanon, we had talked about back in chapter 5. So this isn't his home away from home that she's going to live in. Okay, let's talk Milo. I apologize for rushing people a little bit with this, but there's just so much to talk about. The Milo construction. So here, it sounds like nothing, right? It was one of the buildings that he built in sentence 15. It was what he built up to make the place for her. Fine. But it's going to be critical to Shlomo's downfall, and therefore it's worthy of our conversation. First of all, the first place you encounter the Milo is actually in Shmuel Bet, chapter 5, sentence 9. I referenced it in source number 11. We're not going to look it up right now. It is a place that David builds up after conquering Jerusalem. It is outside Ir David, and David builds up the Milo. It also appears in Divrei Hayamim, Aleph, chapter 11. The word Milo is often read, like I said before, to mean an area that was filled in. so that some suggest there was a low-lying area that was developed into a flat supported surface for construction. Sounds a little bit like Rashi, if you look at source number 12, Rashi on Shmuel Bet, says, Hekef choma nemocha umalino sa'afar. He says, you want to know what the milo is? It's an area with a surrounding low wall that you fill in with dirt. V'gova hatel be'emtza u'meshupa v'holech l'chol ruach. The height of it is in the middle, and then it descends in every direction. So it's actually not entirely flat. The way he's reading it, it's going to have some kind of a slope. Or at least it had a slope before they filled it in, maybe. Hu karoi milo. That's called milo. Va'alav bana David batim. And David built houses on top of this area, this filled-in area called the milo. Rabbi Yitzchak Levy, in an article I gave you a link for in source number 13, suggests that, and it's not just him, I've seen it in others as well, it's the area between Har HaMoriah and Ir David. There's an area in between, and that's where you can find this. If you want to look at the article, you'll see more. That is often suggested. So, okay. A milo is an area that David filled in, and David built up, and now Shlomo is building the palace there. What was the function of the milo before Shlomo came along? What was the milo supposed to be? So if you take a look at source number 14, you find out that commentators are all over the place. I gave you a list. Radak and Malbim in Shmuel Beis say it's an open plaza for people to gather. Okay. Then you have Rabag and Abarbanel in Shmuel who say no, it's a defensive moat. Like you're building a wall and you're filling things in, it's a defensive moat. Ralbag, however, in Malachim, suggests that it's about access to the king for the population. People who have issues they want to bring to the king go that route. And then you have a radical read in Radak, which we're going to come back to, in which he says it's actually a path for the king to flee if there is an insurrection. If people want to attack, this is the way out for the king. It's an escape route for the king. Wildly different explanations.
It's the theology as well.
Yes.
Right? I mean, the same thing could function for all the citizens.
You are entirely right.
GPS tells me the citadel works for three of the four explanations.
If it's a citadel, right, Debbie points out, it could work for three out of the four explanations. It just doesn't work for the moat. Although it could be the citadel has a moat.
Sure.
Yeah. Drawbridge. I don't know when they start doing drawbridges.
But
here's the key. These explanations for why it is a milo, for why this would be the milo, are largely, except for the moat one, I think, are largely based on something that we haven't seen yet. So hang in there and you'll understand where they got this idea from. Why did they have this idea? We're going to explain that. But first we need to ask, I now have different explanations, four of them, for what the milo was before Shlomo built it up. What exactly did Shlomo do when he made it a palace for her? So the text already gives us a clue that something is wrong. Going back to our sentence in Malachim, chapter 9, sentence 24, it began with the word, ach, but, only. That tells you something's up here. It is also oddly singled out in association with the construction of the palace for Bat Paro, right? It doesn't say he made the milo into her palace. It says he built up her palace, then he built up the milo. So Ralbag says it's actually her palace. If you look at source 15, I gave you a list of suggestions. Ralbag says it is her palace. Abarbanel says it's meant to beautify the area around her palace. Rashi says that it's housing for her servants. And Rashi says the word but is meant to say this is something that Shlomo is doing that is no good. The other construction projects are good, but there's something wrong with this construction project. So now we're starting to see something, we're converging on a problem. In other words, if you asked me, I would have read these passages, chapter 9, sentence 15, chapter 9, sentence 24, and said, okay, another Shlomo construction project. Why did he do it? Well, presumably it has to do with the daughter of the Pharaoh, because that's what it says. Then he built up the milo. And I would have ignored it, and I would have kept right on going. But then I would have hit chapter 11. Take a look at chapter 11, sentence 27. And this requires a little bit of introduction. After Shlomo's time, his son Rechavam is going to take over the kingdom. Rechavam is going to have a problem. People are not going to be happy with him. They're going to feel that he is too harsh with them. He is too demanding with them. And when he doesn't respond well, the people are going to split off. He's going to lose the 10 northern tribes. They are led by a man named Yerovam ben Nevat. Meet Yerovam ben Nevat. Chapter 11, sentence 26. The Yerovam ben Nevat Ephrati min Hatzereda. Yerovam ben Nevat was from, it seems, Ephraim. We'll see if we get to discuss him, then we'll talk about Ephrati. But the point is not that. The point is not that his mother's name is Tzru'ah either. He is an Eved Lishlomo. He works for Shlomo. Vayorem Yad Bamelech. He raised his hand against the king. What does that mean? Vizad Davar Shahirim Yad Bamelech. This is that for which he raised his hand against the king. You want to know what made him rebel? Shlomo Bana Es HaMilo. Shlomo built up the Milo. Sagar es peretz ir David Aviv, he closed up the breach of his father David. And apparently that is what angered Yerovam ben Nevat. There was something here that Shlomo did that angered Yerovam. Do we understand anything yet? So good. This is what leads to Ralbag's comment. It's either, not just Ralbag, but I'll take the two easiest ones. Radak and Malbim said it was an open plaza for gathering. Ralbag said it's access to the king. Along comes the king with his wife from Egypt, and he says, I am now taking away your green space, right? Your public area, your park. And I'm going to build a palace for my wife, right? Whose father gave me a nice gift, by the way. He conquered Gezer. You start to understand, because Yerovam is going to come across as a populist. Yeah, that's what he's all about. It's all about the people, and Rechavam is too harsh to the people. Yerovam is a populist, and he says, what you did wasn't right, and I am going to lead a revolt against you.
Yeah. Close off passage to his wife's palace.
So that's the question, is what is this passage used for? So take a look at your sheet at source number 16, the Gemara in Sanhedrin. The Gemara in Sanhedrin, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Sanhedrin Kuf Aleph Amud Beis, 101b. Rabbi Yochanan says, Mipnei ma zacha Yerovam lamalchus. Why did Yerovam merit the throne? Why does God enable him to become a king? Mibnei shochiach Shlomo, because he rebuked Shlomo. In other words, he was right. What Shlomo did was wrong. Mibnei manenash. Well, then why was he punished? Because Yerovam, unfortunately, doesn't end well. Mibnei shochicho barabim, because he rebuked Shlomo in public. Shneamar, like the Pasuk says, it's the verse we just read. I didn't bother to translate it here. Amarlo, he said to Shlomo, David avicha paratz pirzos bachoma. Here you go with your answer, Beruya. Kidei sheyalu Yisrael laregel. This was meant to be a path for people to get to the Beis Hamikdash when they are coming for the Chag, for the festival. The ata gadarta osam. You broke through those breaches in the wall. Kidei lasos angaria labas paro. In order to create an angaria for the daughter of the Pharaoh. Your father helped people make the pilgrimage, and you closed it off in honor of the Pharaoh's daughter. How dare you, Shlomo? That's the idea. Now, it's important to understand you really have two different issues going on. I cheated on a word here, the word angaria. I'm going to come back to it. There are two pieces here. Number one, Shlomo, you took away the public space. And number two, you used the public space for bat paro, for angaria. In terms of taking away the public space, there's an obvious read, which is you took away the thoroughfare. You took away the royal access, the access to the king, right? That's one read. But Radak says no. Radak is number 17, but I see the time, and there's so much I want to talk about that I'm not going to read it inside. I did translate it for you there. Radak says, in his day, Radak, I believe, is end of the 13th century. He's in the 13th century, I'm pretty sure. He says, the practice of Ishmaelite kings in my day is that they leave an escape route from their palaces. It's called the treason gate, Shar HaBeged, in order to be able to get out. Shlomo seals it up. He says, I'm not worried. And Yeravam says, look at the chutzpah of this guy. He thinks that he can just, you know, do whatever he wants. How dare he? That's the way Radak reads what happens there. So this is all one point. Taking away the public space, and with it, a demonstration of hubris, according to Radak. Other approach, very un-Radak, by the way. Like, it's not quoting a medrash. He's just, like, telling you this is it. It's very Abarbanel-like. It's much more Abarbanel than Radak. The other issue is using the space for Angaria, for the daughter of the Paro. The word Angaria, normally when it's an Aramaic word, it's not one of ours, normally means a work gang doing things on behalf of the government. That's the normal meaning of what Angaria is. What does it mean here, though? So Rashi has multiple comments. He says, and it's in source number 18, but again, because of time, I'm just going to list it for you. You can read my translation there. He first brings you the idea that it was about collecting taxes from those who entered for Bat Paro. In other words, it wasn't just that he built her palace there. In this area that had been the public space, he now puts a toll. Yep. And the money goes to the daughter of the Pharaoh. That's one approach. Second approach, he wanted there to be mobs of people in the area there in order to honor Pharaoh's daughter as they pass by. It's a tribute to her. That's a second approach. And then a third approach, I'm just muting because I'm getting background noise. And then a third approach is based on a Medrash in Vayikra Rabbah, which we've discussed before. In source number 19, you see the text of it. A Medrash that says that Shlomo slept in the night that they dedicated the Beis HaMikdash. That's also supposed to be the night of his marriage to the daughter of the Pharaoh, although we saw him marry her back in chapter 3. That's its own discussion. But the Medrash puts the two together and says that he sleeps late afterwards, and they need the keys to the Beis HaMikdash. He has the keys with him. So this Medrash here in source number 19 has an interesting twist on it. Shlomo is sleeping until the fourth hour of the day, as told here in source number 19, and he has the keys, and they need to go to get the keys. Says Rashi, quoted or based on this Medrash, he's holding the keys, and now people are going to have to bribe her to get the keys to the Beis HaMikdash. So Yeravam says to Shlomo, look what you're doing. You want them to pay Pharaoh's daughter to give them the keys to the Beis HaMikdash? That's the rebuke in the third approach in Rashi. We have much more to talk about in terms of how this fits into the overall story of Shlomo and Yeravam. I would love to say we're going to get to do that. I don't know exactly how at this point, but nonetheless. This is clearly your second warning sign with the daughter of Paro. Right, your first warning sign is he's taking care of conquering the land and giving it to Shlomo. And now your second warning sign is Shlomo is taking away a public area on behalf of the palace for Paro's daughter. An area that may have even been to enable the Jews to go to the Beis HaMikdash for Aliyah LaRegel. Like, how in the world can you do that? However, I go back to what I said in the beginning of this chapter. Shlomo remains ambiguous. Take a look at sentence 23 in our chapter. Chapter 9, sentence 23. No, sorry, not 23. 25. After it lists the construction and before it talks about his voyages for gold. V'helash Shlomo shalosh pamim bashana olosu shlamim ala mizbeach asher bana l'Hashem. Shlomo brings sacrifices three times a year to God in the Beis HaMikdash. He has a special celebration, and as I noted on your sheet in source number 20, there's a parallel verse in Divrei Hayamim Bet, that verse tells us it's for the three holidays. It's Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot. Here it doesn't say that. It just says three times a year. There it tells us it's for these festivals. So Shlomo is still bringing his karbanos to God. It's juxtaposed with Bat Paro and the Milo and the gold, right? We have concerns about Shlomo, but he is still the beloved of God despite that. It's really remarkable. That concludes chapter 9. I would love to pause here for comments, but I'm going to launch right into chapter 10. I got 5 minutes and I plan to use them. So I gave you the review questions on the sheet. Hopefully that will be of some help to make sure we don't forget what we've learned. This was a big chapter. A lot happened. Chapter 10, the Queen of Sheba is going to visit. It's going to be awesome. She's very impressed by Shlomo. She's really impressed. Then we get all of his great wealth, his fantastic throne we'll have to talk about, his international standing. Everybody is really impressed with Shlomo from all the different lands, and he is amassing a lot of horses, and the people are becoming wealthy. That's the major thing you need to know about chapter 10. This is what could be called utopia. And I've talked about this, those of you who learned Yeshaya with me, we talked about this at length in Yeshaya. But I'll discuss it briefly here as well, because not everybody was in Yeshaya. We also talked about it a little bit back in chapter 4, chapter 5. The Torah gives us a vision for what our goal is, what we want to achieve. If you go back, use your Tanakh, it's worth it to go back and see it inside. Devarim chapter 28, the beginning of the chapter. Parshas Kisavo. It's page 491 in the stone Tanakh. Remember that the Jews thought they were about to go into the land of Israel at the end of the book of Vayikra, right? We've been reading in the Parsha about how they thought they were going to go in. And so at the end of Sefer Vayikra and Parshas Bechukosai, we had a message for the Jews. If you follow my mitzvahs, things will be wonderful for you in the land. You don't follow them, you get a horrible, horrible set of punishments, you get kicked out of the land. Then, Meraglim, the spies, 40 years in the wilderness. Again, they're on the cusp of entering the land, and in Parshas Kisavo, they get, again, a promise of what will be if you do good, and a warning of what will be if you make a mistake. I'll give you three guesses for what happened. But if you take a look in this passage, in chapter 28, starting in sentence 1, you get the Torah's clearest expression of what we are trying to achieve in Tanakh. You want to know what the goal is in Tanakh? What's the end game? The end game is exactly what you see here. You perform all of the commandments that I am commanding you, Hashem says. If you're doing what I tell you to do, that's item number one. Then what will happen? You will be supreme over all the nations of the earth. You will have security. You will be safe from everybody else. And then he continues to say, you'll get all of these blessings, blessed in the city, in the field, fruit of your womb, fruit of your ground, animals, cattle. You will have ultimate prosperity. Everything that you could want to excel in, all the property that you want to have, you will get. In sentence 7, in that section, you find Hashem will cause your enemies to be struck down before you. So again, you are safe from your enemies. Keep on reading. Hashem will give you blessing in your storehouses with every undertaking. Hashem will confirm you for himself as a holy people as he swore to you. Then all the peoples of the earth will see that the name of Hashem is proclaimed over you. It isn't only that they will not be a threat to you, but they will also recognize the name of Hashem proclaimed over you. That reverence for God is a key piece of it. The reverence for the Torah that we are supposed to be representing and practicing is a key piece over it. So what we're seeing here is a four-part vision. The vision for what we're supposed to achieve is piety, prosperity, security, and international reverence for Hashem and for Torah. We saw this in Yeshaya chapter 11, when we had that vision also of a great king who is going to lead us, who will judge with piety, and it's a period of prosperity, and you'll be safe, the wolf with the lamb and the whole bit in that section. And again, people coming to you and saying, we want to learn Torah. Mitzion Teitei Torah, we would like to learn your Torah. The Rambam has this as his vision for the time of Mashiach. I brought it for you in source number 23. The Rambam in Hilchos Malachim, in the Laws of Kings, his same description is coming off of those psukim in Devarim. It's the same exact thing. He doesn't reference it, but he says to you, this will be a period when there's lots of benefit, there's lots of bounty, delicacies as common as dust. And the whole world just wants to pursue knowledge of God. And the Jews are themselves going to be great sages at that point. There is no war at that point. It's these same four elements. That's what you're going to hear with Shlomo, with the visit by the Queen of Sheba. This chapter is mission accomplished. We got what we wanted. Right here, for a fleeting moment in time, there will be piety, there will be prosperity, there will be security, there will be international reverence for Hashem and for Torah, and then it's going to all go south. But this is the chapter that we're aiming for, so God willing, next week, we're going to talk about the visit by the Queen of Sheba. We'll talk a little bit about Shlomo's throne, and then we're going to move into chapter 11 and the downturn, where things go bad. And that's what we'll have to do, God willing, next week. If I'm not able to figure out how to fit it into an hour, I'm going to come back to you and ask you what to do about that. We'll have to figure that out. But right now, my goal is that we should get a real understanding of it next week. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you.